we're building a radio network where every user on the network will be a channel on our system.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the world's worst program.
I am a DJ, I am what I play.
I'm taping.
Good evening, folks. This is Ross Rader coming at you as live as I can be from Casa Disco in Toronto, Ontario, Canada for November 21st, 2004. Got a great big show this week. It's interview week, I guess, over here at Random Bites. We've got an hour of content, at least, that I need to pack in over the next hour. It's a great thing about being live. First up, though, we've got an episode, a new episode of Two Drunk Marketing Guys doing a recap of the recent ISPCon in Santa Clara, California, and then after that, an interview that I've been excitedly waiting to do all week. Brett Fawcett's going to tell us how to get legit with our podcast firsthand. He walks us through the ins and outs that he just went through to get totally licensed up, as he says. But quickly, I've got an apology, actually, to make on two different fronts. First off, didn't mean to go mono on you last week. That was just a little bit of a Winamp plug-in problem that I had. I use the crossfading plug-in, and I'd set it to record at 44 kilohertz mono instead of 44 kilohertz stereo. Silly me. Anyways. The other apology is for Jason over at Hardcore Insomnia Radio. I called you a pod pirate. Well, I implied that you were a pod pirate. Certainly didn't mean to. It wasn't you that has the bad attitude. It was Eric Rice. Jason, you're totally rea-free from what I can tell. You know that. I know that. Now hopefully all my listeners know that too. You get a plug. Eric doesn't. He's a badass. You're not. So if you're listening, if you want to get involved and listen to Hardcore Insomnia Radio, I do so. It's great. I listen to it every time. I'm a permanent subscriber. Hardcore Insomnia Radio. Check my weblog, www.byte.org, for a link. I'll stick it in the show notes. And I'm going to be removing all links to Eric Rice, just because he's a badass. He's not Rhea-friendly. Anyways. In the meantime, got some great news earlier today. I do want to share this before we move on to the show. My sister has gone into labor after longer for her than for me. So sometime over the next little bit, probably the next few hours actually, I'll be a new uncle. Second time. Anyways, good luck everybody. Allison, Len, be thinking of you. And here's Two Drunk Marketing Guys. Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Ross Rader from Random Bites Radio with another installment of Two Drunk Marketing Guys. I've got Doug McDonald on the line with me. How are you doing today, Doug?
I'm doing very well, and how are you?
Good, 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 good. Now, you're not in the same room or the same country as I am right now, are you?
I am not. I'm actually in my dining room in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Very good. Well, I'm actually in my... what is this room? We've moved into a new house here. Well, as everybody kind of knows, it's not new, it's old. And I don't know what the room is yet. The computer room, the den, the dungeon, I suppose it is. So anyways, I've known Doug for a long, long time. And one thing we didn't do on the last installment of Two Drunk Marketing Guys was actually introduce Doug. So maybe Doug could take a couple seconds right now to explain who he is, what he does, and why people should ignore him just as much as they ignore me.
Well, as he said, my name is Doug McDonald. I run and own my own business development marketing consulting firm based from wherever I am, which happens to be Harrisburg, Pennsylvania right now. Switches back and forth between the United States and Canada. Prior to that, I spent about a year and a half with Hostopia, and prior to that, I spent a little better than 5 years working along with Mr. Rader at Two Caps. So I guess that qualifies me for, I don't know, maybe some sort of internet longevity award, but other than that, it means that I've been around a little bit and I've seen this business from a bunch of different places and seen it change a bit.
Well, I think at the very least it qualifies you for our sympathy.
Absolutely.
Indeed. So what kind of things are you working on now?
I'm working with people who are trying to sell things to or through internet service providers. So I work largely as an interface between companies whose customers would be internet service providers or customers of internet service providers, and work with them to try and hone their message a little bit more, work a little bit on honing their product to make a little bit more sense, and put together sales programs to make it enticing, at least, or at the very least interesting for internet service providers to catch their attention.
Very cool. Any customers you want to plug? Anybody you're working with now that's doing some cool things?
I have non-disclosures with most of my people, and the other ones tend to compete with you, so that's probably not a good idea.
Very good. So this week on Two Drunk Marketing Guys, or at least on this segment, it's not exactly a weekly show yet, is it?
No.
We've got a couple of things. Now, both of us were in Santa Clara a couple weeks ago for ISPCon, and I don't know about you, Doug, but it's certainly the show is back. It was great. There was people there. There was money there. There were suppliers there. There were customers there. There was rarely a room that was empty. Certainly, the sessions went well. The trade show floor was moderately busy throughout the day. It looks like ISPs are back and ISPCon is back. What did you take away from the show?
I took away very much the same thing. I mean, ISPs never really went anywhere. They you know, they've always been where they were. They're just now a little bit more willing to get out of the office and at the very least entertain new ideas. You know, for, well, I guess the better part of 4 years there, I mean, they really have just been in survival mode. And you know, doing everything they could to stay in business. Now they're looking, from what I gathered from the show, from sort of from the overall feeling and from individual conversations, I mean, they're really looking at beyond survival now. They've survived. They believe the worst is over. It's now how do we grow? How do we get back to where we were? Both in terms of a money factor and an excitement factor inside their own business and with their own customers. So the money was back at ISPCon. There were a good number of decent deals done, but the excitement was back, and that to me is more important. There's optimism in this industry again.
So you say the money was back. Now, I tend to share that. The excitement was back. My question, though, is that optimism well-placed, or is this just a little bit of a bubble and the guys that have stuck their head out of the ground like those little gophers are going to get them run over with that lawn tractor that's coming that we call the economy that's coming down the way?
If I knew the answer to that, I'd be making a whole lot more money than I am right now.
Fair dues.
I believe the optimism is well-founded. I believe the optimism is actually probably, 12 to 18 months too late.
Mm-hmm.
Small business, cautious owners wanting to make sure that this is as bad as it's going to get, I think is had a lot to do with the delay. I think a lot of, telephone deregulation is scaring them to look at new alternate opportunities for revenue. I mean, they're just looking at, all right, maybe this whole phone thing's going to go away, and the internet, the access component that's traditionally been a big part of my business isn't going to be there anymore, and now I got to look at something else. So, I mean, I saw and talked to an awful lot of people that were looking at non-access products and services to add to their suite of services.
Yeah, I saw a lot of that as well myself. What kind of stuff did you see people looking at in terms of non dial up or non connectivity type options? It wasn't quite clear to me what that buzz winner was. Usually when you go into a show, you get a good sense that a few years ago it was portals were all the rage, or before that. Hosting, ISPs offering hosting was all the rage, and it kind of goes in wave. I didn't get a clear sense at this show that anything in particular was the big standout in that. Did you see any trends there?
I didn't particularly see a clear winner. There was some portal rage there, as you well know. There was also a fair amount of I would say beyond basic hosting, the concept that, you know, hosting has become a commodity, much like dial-up and access has become a commodity, and people looking at what comes beyond, you know, a static web page, and how do I charge more than, you know, $19.99 a month for a small business hosting account? That kind of a conversation, as much as a buzz was going around, you know. There were the accelerators were there doing very well. Propel, you know, through a really nice party that was well attended. I made it to that one. You know, Slipstream was there. ProxyCon was there. You know, Arturo was there. So, you know, sort of from the add-on to access components were there. But I think it was more a change in mentality away from the ones and zeros and nuts and bolts into the dollars and cents of their business. That's the big takeaway that I took from that show. There was far more focus on profit than on geek toys.
Sure, certainly. The and those that weren't directly focusing on the way to drag the last cent out of their margins, there was also a small component that were looking at taking a right-hand turn with their business, getting into the voice markets, getting into the Wi-Fi markets. Any cool stories you've got in that area?
I mean, I talked to a whole bunch of people, and it's, you know, it's a shameless plug. I just finished a big survey, and actually that's why I'm home today. Is I'm doing work on putting together the final report of a big survey that I did on small businesses on the internet and looking at what they were looking at next in the next couple of years. And the clear winner was voice over IP. I think that there's a lot of buzz around voice over IP. You know, we're using it right now to record this. But beyond that, getting into the small business and essentially replacing their legacy, you know, POTS system that they've got in there with total voice solutions, you know, all IP delivered and IP based.
So there's two schools of thought on that market, though. One is one of those schools is that voice is the next wave of opportunity for service providers. The other school is it may look like a great opportunity, but as everything trends towards zero in this market, i.e., when as it becomes more commoditized, the value of actually offering that service as a value add is going to disappear quicker than the dial-up market did. Do you see any interesting approaches to that kind of paradox, whether it be with value-added voice services, you know, different approaches to market regulation, those sorts of things? Anything going on there?
I mean, one thing that I look at is this is one more, and you know, people that are talking about or are actually doing voices, that this is yet another arrow in their quiver. This is one more way that they create an extended relationship with their customer base. You know, the days of just, you know, being able to put a sign up that said internet on it and people beat a path to your door or over and they stayed with you, it just isn't there anymore. A lot of the really savvy ISPs are looking at complete solutions and providing, you know, whether they provide the access or not, they're providing all the really valuable stuff that rides on at the application layer, as we always like to say, not at the network layer. Let's get beyond the network layer and ride on the application layer, because that's really where all the money is, because it's less likely to be commoditized. And when it is commoditized, it's down the road from now. I mean, I look at voice, I mean, personally, I look at voice like I looked at, you know, sort of dial-up access in, you know, in 97. It's, you know, It's the next thing that's coming. The technology is growing as fast as we can keep up with it. And, you know, it's just getting better all the time. And its penetration is, you know, certainly not rivaling that of the internet back in 97. But, I mean, it's the fastest growing component of the internet in my mind.
So a lot of ISPCon isn't necessarily about the panel sessions or the show floor or meeting up with vendors, those sorts of things. It's also, you know, rekindling those connections year after year with those people you've met at past shows. And one of the I think one of the best examples of that this year, Doug, was the ISPCO roundtable session that you ran. It was how long did that thing run?
It finished up
like six hours, 7 hours, something like that.
About somewhere between six and a half hours. We got started really just shortly after six, and we wrapped up you know, sort of in the 12:30 neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to finish at 7.
Sure.
It was really just getting warmed up at 7. I think it really got warmed up right about 8:30, actually, to be honest with you. But
Hey, what's going on?
Just you literally called me just as my connection was coming back up. I just had a power failure.
Oh, nice. Nice. Very good.
I mean, about a second long one, it just blipped on me.
Oh, good.
So everything goes out.
Wow. No problem. So we're still rolling. Just pick that up. You were in the middle of a sentence there.
Session was 6.5 hours long, essentially, and I mean, really, the concept that I moderated it really sort of gives me more credit than I'm due, I think. I mean, I just essentially was the guy standing up at the front of the room that started a couple of conversations that just led to one of those just classic peer-to-peer groups that get together. You know, sometimes they happen in a chamber of commerce, sometimes they happen at the local pub, whatever it is. But I mean, we happen to get, you know, 30, 40 people in the same room, very like-minded, in not all the same position, but you know, certainly in at the head of their ISP, and just let them go, you know, railed them in a couple of times to try and prevent things from, you know, getting into holy wars over
sure.
OSs and whatnot. But other than that, I mean, it really, I was a spectator far more than I was a moderator.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I really saw you just tossing the odd hand grenade in there to, you know, move things along versus actually.
I mean, it really even wasn't so much a hand grenade. Every now and I got again, I got up and walked over the pot and grabbed the spoon and stirred it a little bit and just went back and sat down and, you know, and let people keep going, and or, you know, maybe steered them one way or the other slightly. But I mean, slightly would be as strong a word as I'd ever use for that.
Fair.
It really ran itself.
Fair. What was the, I guess you can call it, the shining moment for you? What was the big lights on, or was it all just kind of standard stuff for you?
There were a couple of shining moments. I mean, there were a couple of real business models in there that I hadn't, you know, I had thought of before, but had never really thought were worth very much, to be honest with you, just to show how smart I am. You know, a couple of guys that were really, you know, doing very well, doing a couple of things. You know, I know that there are a couple of takeaways from it, in that, you know, these guys have just really, what I took away was that these guys are just struggling to survive. They're looking at costs far more than they're looking at revenue. You know, they're looking at that cost line so hard that they're losing focus on a lot of things.
Right, right. Now, one thing that I found just fascinating was, here we are in Santa Clara, heart of Silicon Valley, roughly 3 or 5 minutes away from Cisco's campus, and Cisco was nowhere to be found the entire week. You know, they may have had one or two people walk the floor, but their marketing people didn't see fit to take a booth, have any speakers show up, sponsor a coffee break, never mind their own reception, or really do anything for that service provider community. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was cutting my teeth on this stuff, Cisco was the holy grail of knock gear. And I think that has changed. And Cisco seems to be missing that, certainly within that CEO roundtable session. It was brought up a couple times how, you know, you said it's not that they think that Cisco sucks, it's just they're not using Cisco anymore. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I really would have liked to have seen Cisco there, and I really think Cisco, you know, if somebody in their marketing department hears this or gets to them, I think they're making a real mistake by not being there. Yeah, I know that that the boom days of old in terms of the ISP marketplace are gone, and there's just not, you know, as many big iron boxes being, you know, purchased. But there's still, you know, an incredible market there that they are largely ignoring. If they are not ignoring it on purpose, I can say, I mean, I think you'll agree with me, Ross, that the ISPs feel ignored. They're not, you know, as enthused as they once were with Cisco, because, like, you know, you and I, they were the ones, you know, for the most part,
buying those Cisco boxes and, you know, what has become the Cisco powered network. Well, those Cisco powered networks aren't in the local service providers, you know, by and large anymore.
So who is powering those networks now?
I think it's a hodgepodge of a number of different things. I mean, part of the function of the dot bomb put an awful lot of cheap stuff on eBay, and as you know, Mike Cassidy likes to quote, he says eBay is the world's largest technology VAR. But that gear's running out. It's coming to end of life, and there's just not as much of it, you know, as there once was. With good reason, you know, some of the big hardware people have stayed away from the marketplace because they flooded it, really. And I put a fair amount of blame on them. They flooded it in, you know, 98, 99, 2000. And, you know, credit to the quality of some of the gear that's out there, not just Cisco's, but, you know, Cisco and others, is a lot of that stuff still up and running. So there's no need to replace it right now.
That explains some of Nortel's problems, I guess, eh?
I mean, that explains, well, part of Nortel's problems. The inability to count seems to be another one of them. But ISPs are looking at alternate solutions. They're not buying the $100,000 Cisco router anymore. They're buying, you know, the $10,000 generic open source knockoff solution. And when they are buying the Cisco router, they're not buying the service contract because they're not. I don't think being properly educated on the value of it.
But they are buying Cisco CPE now.
They're buying Cisco CPE. It just doesn't have a Cisco label on it. It's got a Linksys label on it.
Right. And I guess it's $25 a box wholesale, or $50 a box wholesale, whatever those Linksys routers are costing. Cisco's not really taking notice of that.
Yeah, they're not taking notice of it. But you know, you look at Cisco, and I mean, their markets are eroding everywhere. I think that they've ignored. I think they got, you know, too high on their own horse for a while, and didn't do enough to foster some more growth and to, you know, really build upon the dominant position.
Position?
The dominant position. When I mean dominant position, that they were in 5 years ago.
Fair enough. So just before we wrap up, Doug. Best of show. There was a bunch of stuff going on. What was the big standout in your mind?
My wife's not here, so I guess I could say Hoola Network's booth. But best of show. I think best of show has to go.
You got a lot to choose from. You've got you guys over at Propel with some great new products. The guys at Laszlo with some great announcements that they made and some great technologies they were showing. Certainly the Gorilla stuff I was doing, I would place in the top five. What else? Let's at least go through the candidates before you make your picks.
Canadian company. Box needs some cosmetic work, but I really like the technology behind it. Some old Corel guys put together a home and small office gateway server piece. I really like that piece.
Yeah, you were impressed by that. I didn't turn my knobs.
Didn't turn your knobs?
No.
To me, I think it's got great potential. I think it's got a limited application, but that application is growing, and that's just, you know, the connected family in the broadband home, and you know, if that's just the market you go after, boy, that's a pretty good market.
Fair. Pulverguy showing their $800 PBX.
The $800 PBX was nice. There were some 8x8 guys there with they were in somebody else's booth, but you know, they were talking, they were showing their video phone. Doesn't have a lot of application to me, but you know, I've got a VoIP phone. Might be nice to put a video phone over it. It does have, I mean, it's an office phone. It's not your home phone, but I mean, it had a great application for some small office stuff. That was another one that I saw that I was really quite impressed with.
So what's your pick?
Actually, I think the $800 PBX is probably my pick.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. When does that become an $80 PBX is my question.
Isn't it already?
Exactly. It's certainly, I was talking to their guys that had put that together, and they had a hard time making it $800, but they felt that if it wasn't worth somewhere north of $500, that nobody would take it seriously, which is, you know, hilarious when you think of it.
Yeah, I mean, I saw online here a couple of days ago. I mean, just the cost of a VoIP office. You know, if you went, you know, and here's another example of where maybe somebody's missed the boat. I mean, you go on a Cisco powered VoIP installation for an enterprise, you're looking at north of $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
You go at something on the in between level, a brand name in between level, and you're still looking at $500,000. You go with one of these $800 PBXs that works with a regular telephone, whether you spend the extra money on the video phones or not, and do some upgrades. But you can buy some basic old used Nortel phones that'll work on it, and you can do the same office that was going to, on a Cisco powered network, cost $1.1 million was $110,000. For the same size of enterprise class installation.
And presumably you'd be buying all that used equipment through the guys at Hula Networks, right?
And you may well be buying a good bit of it from the guys at Hula Networks. And I really hope people do patronize Hula Networks, because I took advantage of their hospitality, shall we say?
Yes, and it's important that Hula Networks continues to grow and remains a force in this industry, so that Hula Networks shows up at the next ISPCon with their hospitality.
Yes.
And I think on that note, let's wrap things up, Doug. Certainly a pleasure, always a pleasure. Are we going to do this again?
Absolutely. At your convenience, sir.
At my convenience. That's great. Well, thanks a ton. I will let you get back to your day, and I will leave my listeners with this little track to let us go. Thanks a lot, folks, and thank you, Doug. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Take care.
So there we go, another episode of Two Drunk Marketing Guys. We're going to flip over to my next interview real quick, but first I've got some iguanas for you. Zacatecas. Enjoy.
sun. I want to lay right there when the digging is done. Zacatecas. Come on. Zacatecas. Come on, come on. Zacatecas. A Zacatecas, pa Zacatecas, Zacatecas, pa Zacatecas, Zacatecas.
That's a good fun track from the Iguana, Zacatecas. I was feverishly trying to Google Zacatecas while I was playing that one. Close as I can figure, it's some place, somewhere else in the world. Cerro de Zacatecas. Actually, looks like a mountain range or something like that. I'll try and maybe dig something up that explains that a little bit further next week. So as I mentioned, I've got an interview here that I'm pretty excited about. Last week's podcast, I had talked about how cheap it was to get a license for the music on your podcast so that you can be legit and do the right thing and not only keep yourself clean, but keep the good name of podcasting unsullied. So apparently, somebody, there is at least one of you that listens to this, took that as a challenge and decided to do some digging as to what it would take to actually be a legit podcaster. His name is Brett Fawcett, and I sat down with him for about half an hour this afternoon, and we had a chat. So here's my talk with Brett, and hopefully it spreads the good word about what you can do to get on the right side of the line. Here you go, me and Brett. So as I've been promising, and as Brett has been promising, I've got a special guest today, Brett Fawcett, and he's going to talk a little bit about, or a lot about, hopefully, about what he's doing with his podcast. And I don't want to give away the surprise because I think it's really cool and really special. How you doing, Brett?
I'm doing very well, thank you very much. Nice intro music. Yes, it's right out of my the style of music that I've been playing on my podcast.
I gotta say that I have liked some of the stuff you've been playing, even though I've been knocking the music of the mainstream as being absolute crap on my podcast. I do say it's nice to hear some Dire Straits once in a while.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that when I said I was going to broadcast RIAA music under license, some people did drop me a note and say, "Why in the world would you want to do that? Because all that music is junk." And you know, I think it's not junk. I mean, it wasn't my ambition to play a lot of Britney Spears and stuff like that. I wasn't going to play Bubblegum, you know, top 40. But, you know, there's a lot of good stuff under the RIAA and the licensed music. And, you know, I'm going to play some of it, but a lot of indie stuff, too.
Very cool. Very cool. So tell me about yourself, Brett. You've got a long and storied background.
Well, I don't know about long or storied, but I'm a lawyer in Los Angeles and have, you know, we run into each other a lot in the ICANN circles because I've been ICANN blogging since 2000 and recently started podcasting some ICANN blogs. And then I just decided that this podcasting stuff was too cool not to, you know, sort of hop on and see where it takes me. And I thought I would try to broadcast some music too.
So how did you make the jump from being a blogger to being a podcaster? Actually, I should state, too, that you were one of the people that were instrumental in getting me interested in blogging. I kept going to your weblog and reading it, and I said, you know what? He's got a great soapbox there. I gotta do that. And I can't remember where we were when I asked you what software you were using, but I downloaded it that afternoon, and I've been a blogger ever since.
I think we were actually in Accra, Ghana.
Fair enough, of all places. Yeah. So how did you make the jump from being a regular mainstream text blogger to being a really cool, hip podcaster?
I just love podcasting. It is now, you know, you mentioned on your last podcast that someone had captured your drive time, and that is absolutely the case with me. I'm listening to podcasts as I wash the dishes at night, as I make the coffee in the morning. I'm listening to podcasts in the car. you know, sort of whenever I would normally listen to radio, I'm now listening to podcasts.
Wow.
I thought it was an incredible medium, and I had to hop on.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, you're also doing some really cool things with your podcast. First off, you know, give yourself a plug. Where's your website at?
A couple of places. You can get to my written weblog through LexText, LexText.com. There's sort of links that will take you to, you know, all of the relevant places there. And I'm going to put up, though it's not live now, my RIAA licensed podcasts at internet.pro. It was sort of the best unused domain name I had sitting around on the shelf, so I thought I'd pull it out for the internet radio thing.
It's a great domain name, actually. now those within those podcasts, you've mentioned a couple times now that you're actually podcasting Rhea Music,
yes.
And I think you're one of the few guys doing it legally. So why did you go that route?
Well, I wanted.
Other than the fact you're a lawyer.
Well, I am a lawyer. I felt like I could, you know, at least see where the minefields were, so I could, you know, negotiate and navigate the playing field. And I think it's the future of radio. And I wanted to get licensed up and make sure that it could be done. And, you know, there's no better way to do it than sort of get my hands dirty and to do it and see if it works.
So was that playing field really a minefield? Was it easy? Was it difficult? Walk me through the steps, maybe.
Well, there are, for any sound recording, there are two copyrights. There's the copyright owned by the songwriter. That's for the words and sort of the notes on the page. And then there is the copyright of the sound recording itself. That's the performer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times, you know, with Lennon and McCartney and the Beatles, you know, the songwriter and the performer, they're the same people. But, you know, often they're different people, and so different people are getting different royalties. So before you're going to play licensed music on air, you've got to make sure you're cool with both the songwriters and the performers. And the first, and so there are places you go for each of those sides.
Okay.
RIAA, or the RIAA, is the sound recording side. They represent the record labels, the music studios, and they are the people who are putting out sound recordings. And so their license collection agency, so to speak, is called Sound Exchange, and they're at soundexchange.com. And you can find out, you know, all you need to know about getting the RIAA sound recording performance license there. And then on the songwriting side, you know, you've got a lot of songwriting copyright houses. Broadcast Music, more commonly known as BMI, is one of the big ones. ASCAP is even bigger than BMI, I think. And then there's a smaller one, but that's coming along, called CESAC, CESAC.com. And so those three are, I think, the main, you know, songwriting licensors out there. So you go to all of those places and you arrange for a sound recording.
Now, is that a difficult process for you, or is it something you pick up the phone and drop a quarter in the slot?
You know, BMI is great. And I initially thought BMI was so cool about this that I just wanted to do nothing but play BMI music, because BMI, you can go online, and literally, if someone went to BMI.com right now, by the end of this interview, they could have themselves set up with a BMI license. It's all done online. You put in your name, the URL from which you're going to broadcast. You give them a credit card. They charge you quarterly, and they, you know, prorate it for whatever is left in the quarter. And boom, you know, they email you back the contract. It is great. That they're the only people who let you do that online, though.
I see.
ASCAP, you have to, you know, fill out an agreement and send it in. Same thing with Sound Exchange. Same thing with CESAC. You know, there are, and you don't necessarily, for some of these, and I can't remember which are which, unfortunately, right now, but some of them you don't need to even send anything in until the first quarter after you've finished after you first started.
So you
have to take the initiative, and there are reporting forms, and you have to say, you know, these are how many downloads I had, this is how much revenue I generated, and here is your share.
Well, that's the crux of the matter there, making sure they get their share. What does that look like? I'd heard rumors that this is in the sort of mid-hundreds of dollars a year.
But is it that limited,
or is there really just, it could be an unbounded cost for a podcaster?
That's what I was trying to figure out, and I don't believe it's an unbounded cost if you, you still there?
I'm still here.
Okay, sorry. My screensaver went in, so I wasn't sure if you were still here. Anyway, I wanted to make sure it wasn't unbounded, and I should back up a little bit and say that a couple of years ago, people were going online with their own internet radio, and they were doing it, and the studios weren't giving them a license, and there was a big battle, and finally, Congress, at least in the U.S., came in and said, okay, we're going to create this statutory webcasting license that if you meet these criteria, you can play RIA music and pursuant to what they call the statutory webcasting license. And the Library of Congress will set the royalty rate. You know, so we're not going to let these people, you know, set, you know, usurious, you know, royalty rates. It's going to be set by a neutral third party.
So the government gets to do the gouging then?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
But, you know, people sent in petitions and made their positions known to the Library of Congress. And the Library of Congress came out a few years ago with their statutory fees. And hold on a second. So, sorry for that. Pardon the interruption.
It's all live. It's okay.
You can edit this out. Congress came out with statutory fees, and now the first thing you have to do to get that is you have to send the Library of Congress a notice of intent to use the statutory license. That was the first thing I did. And you send them a $20 filing fee. And so $20, and you've sent the notice of intent. You know, anyone who owns music can go to the Library of Congress and see who has said that they're going to use the statutory of license,
right.
And go to the URLs that you're going to put in, and look at you know, who it is, and investigate them if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And then the royalty rates are set, but to qualify, and this is where it gets interesting, and this is where it gets hard for podcasters. To qualify for the webcasting license, you have to meet certain criteria. Actually, RIA itself has a very good set of conditions on its FAQ, on its website at RIA.com.
Do you mean good or comprehensive?
Comprehensive.
Okay.
And it's FAQ question number 6, or what are the conditions that a webcaster has to meet in order to qualify for the statutory license? And then there are, you know, several things here, and they make allowances for looped programming for people who are streaming. You can just loop the performance and have it play, you know, in succession.
Mm-hmm,
there are certain
mm-hmm.
criteria there. There's another one for programs that play at a, you know, given time each day or each week. And there's another one for something that they call archive programming. And archive programming is sort of what a podcast is. It is a program that is stored on a server that may be listened to repeatedly by listeners on demand.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's pretty much the definition of a podcast.
It sounds very much like a podcast, but what's the catch?
The catch is that those cannot be shorter than 5 hours in length.
That's sort of problematic.
That is problematic for a podcast. The other condition is that the 5-hour podcast can only stay on the server for 2 weeks. So after 2 weeks, you have to take it down.
Okay.
So it can only live for 2 weeks, and it has to be 5 hours long. And so my first podcast was, I think, about 45 minutes of speech and language,
mm-hmm.
followed by 4 hours and 15 minutes of what I called quiet meditation. I gave the listeners a thought for the day, and I said that, you know, I thought that they should really meditate on that for the next 4 hours and 15 minutes. And
that caps your licensing. That's enough to cap your licensing.
I say it is.
That's great.
And I don't think it's a gray area at all. You know, I looked at the statutory language. It says 5 hours. It doesn't. You know, I don't think it says 5 hours of speech or 5 hours of, you know, music or anything like that. You know, there's some other restrictions on it. You can't play more than 3 songs from an album. You can't play more than 2 songs from the same album in succession.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You can't list on your website what songs you've played, because obviously they don't want people, you know, searching for, you know, I want the latest Madonna song, and here I found a podcast that has it in. I'm going to go listen to that and splice it out.
Right, right.
You can't enable users to pull the songs out of the podcast automatically.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't put little beeps and blips and things in there that can be read electronically so that the songs can be pulled out. You know, obviously, I think the five-hour limit, they wanted to place some bandwidth limitations on it. I think they also wanted to place, you know, wanted to make sure that you didn't play an entire album and call it a broadcast.
Right.
You know, sort of, you know, letting people steal an entire album.
But they forgot that a podcast of 5 hours, of which four hours and 30 minutes is silence, will actually compress down to roughly the same as a 30-minute podcast.
Well, it does. And, you know, one of the problems I'm having, though, with the five-hour podcasts is that if you play the MP3 in QuickTime, for mm-hmm. example, it shows up as a five-hour podcast. If you play it in Windows Media Player, for some reason, I think the first one I did came in at an hour and 26 minutes. And so Windows Media Player does something strange with silence.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. But, you know, I recorded it as a five-hour podcast in Sony SoundForge, and QuickTime and a lot of other MP3 players see it as a five-hour podcast, but Windows Media Player doesn't see it that way.
Well, let's hope that if it ever comes down to whoever is questioning you is using an Apple device and not a Windows one.
Yeah, that's what you hope, right?
So over the year then, under the statutory license, you figure you're going to pay roughly how much in licensing?
You know, I should say, a minute ago you asked me whether these would be uncapped. And you can cap your licensing fee by making an election. And you have to do something affirmative here. You have to, you know, write to Sound Exchange, and you have to write to the Library of Congress, and you tell them that you're making the election to pay royalties as a share of revenue. And so then your royalties actually are capped by your revenue. So if you're not making a lot of money, then you will pay a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be, a few hundred dollars a quarter. But you won't find that, you have to mortgage your house to, you know, pay
sure.
for being slashdotted or something.
Now, can you change that election annually or something?
You can change it every quarter, I think.
That's great. That's great. So if you find that you're getting successful with your program, you can change your basic ground rules around your finances and actually keep your licensing fees in line with actually where your revenue is. That's great.
Yeah, if your revenue is going through the roof and you want to start playing on a per-song level, you know, you can do that. In fact, that's the default. You know, if you don't make the revenue percentage election, then you have to pay by song.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are a few more bells and whistles in here, you know, sort of an obligation to, not encourage copyright infringement, and sort of loose obligations to identify the song and artist and album whenever possible, you know, things like that. So I would think that anyone who's going to do this was going to need to read the licensing requirements of the statute very closely.
Now, I went through some of those in preparation for this discussion, and it was real thick legal stuff, Brett. Is there a layman's guide to this stuff anywhere? Like, you know, podcasting licensing for dummies, maybe?
Well, not that I've seen. The RIA site's actually not that bad. I mean, they do try to do two things. They do try to explain it, and then they do try to punch you out to the actual statutory language if you want to see that up in a pop-up window. You know, maybe it just didn't seem that hard to me because I'm a lawyer and that's sort of what I do.
So this really is a very comprehensive hobby for you then.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. No, I'm having fun.
That's great. That's great. But just quickly back to the question of cost. You said a couple hundred dollars per quarter. That's sort of borderline expensive habit in my books.
Yeah.
Do you have any plans for you know, underwriting that somehow or tip jars? You know, what are your thoughts there?
Well, exactly. And you know, keep in mind, I have a license, and so and this is where I think it gets interesting. You know, I have a license, but you could do a podcast playing RIA music and I could put it on my server and we could broadcast that on under my license. So people can share a license. And so, you know, this is where I think there's an incredible opportunity here. And, you know, part of me says I should just quit my job as a lawyer, go get venture capital or, you know, mortgage the house and start setting up internet radio stations in which people can start feeding me, you know, RIA produced music and, you know, we could just do nothing but this. So you can share the costs.
And what's the other half of you saying?
Well, this is the same.
You haven't told your wife yet, have you?
The other half of me is the same half of me that stayed in private practice throughout the internet boom.
Yeah. Very good. Very good.
But you know, I'm just fascinated by this. And I think there's real opportunity here, but yes, I am, putting up a Amazon associate links. I'm going with Google Ads, mm-hmm. doing all this at the Internet Pro site, so you can see a bunch of Amazon links there. You can see the they just got approved for the Google Ads on Friday, so they're right now they're rotating the public service ads through there, but I'm hoping that start getting some pay ads rotating through there too, and you know, going to have a PayPal tip jar. So you know, I think, and we'll see how it goes for a quarter. You know, if I'm out a few hundred dollars for the first quarter, and it looks like, you know, this is a hobby that can't sustain itself through, you know, just the simple ways that bloggers have to raise money, you know, then I'll stop. Certainly not gonna, you know, underwrite it for forever. I thought I'd see how it goes, and I think, you know, a couple of $1,000, I think you can get that with PayPal and you know, associate links and Google Ads.
Yeah, no, I think you're right there, and it's at the very least, it's a great experiment. Have you written any of this up? Is there a Brett Fawcett how-to coming out on this?
Hey, you just got it.
That's great. That's great. Well, I do want to thank you for your time, Brett. I almost called you Bruce. I don't know where that came from.
Me either.
And your podcasts are at www.internet.pro. And at
That's where they'll be. There's nothing there right now.
Okay.
You can get some of the old podcasts. I've done all of 7 or 8 now through the LexText.com site. But keep watching internet.pro, and I think maybe by the end of the week, I'll have some stuff up there.
Well, that's great, Brett. Thanks again.
All right.
Now, isn't that some of the coolest stuff that you've heard in a long, long time? I'm just blown away at how quickly this stuff is building on itself, and you've got smart guys like Brad jumping into it and pushing the envelope and doing it cleanly. The future's so bright. You gotta wear shades. Well, that's the end of my show, ladies and gentlemen. Here we are at the 800-minute mark now, something like that. 56 minutes and 51 seconds. So I'm gonna get out of here. Sunday night, got another week coming up on us real quick here. 20 minutes or so. The next time you talk to me, there'll be a new kid in the family. That'll be pretty exciting. Looking forward to that. Anyways, folks, This is it for me. I'm Ross Rader. This is Random Bytes Radio. If you got any comments, drop me an email, ross@2cows.com. Thanks a lot, and have a great one. Proud. Above all else, don't let Monday get you down. Cheers, folks.